I'm Shaima Khalil, and you're listening to The Response, America's Story, from the BBC World Service with American Public Media. The program lets you share your stories with the rest of the world using the voice recorder on your smartphone. It's a program where you take control. Your voices, your stories, recorded and submitted by you in the first 100 days of Donald Trump's presidency. So far, we've been in West Virginia to hear what you want from the new man in the White House. We've gathered your health stories in Kansas City, your stories of immigration in San Antonio, and for this episode, we're in Boise, Idaho, at KBSX, hearing about how the first 100 days of this presidency have been for you. And we'll begin with one woman's very specific reaction to the election of Donald Trump. She got married.
I'm Kate, and I live in Ypsilanti, Michigan. My partner and I have been together 23 years. We're a lesbian couple. And the election happened, and suddenly it was like, crap, we can't wait, and we're just getting married right now.
I didn't even want to wait until the inauguration. This gave my partner me some phone calls, like, what do you do? Oh, you get a marriage license. So she found out, well, hey, we could get married at the city hall. The mayor can marry us. It was just, like, the easiest and fastest thing to do. I tried to, like, find something to wear, you know, something pretty. I just wore, like, a black skirt and a nice blouse. I mean, that's what I had, so that's what I wore. I didn't think I would feel any different. Because we've been together 23 years and I felt really married, but I did feel really different. I mean, we had to sign papers, the mayor was there, there were witnesses. I mean, it was just very official. And suddenly you have the sense that I'm just like heterosexual couples and I should get the same kind of treatment.
Kate looks back at the wedding now, and despite all the happy memories, she's sad that her big day was driven not just by passion, but by politics.
It was really feeling like, I don't know what's going to happen with the Supreme Court or however they might structure the laws, that if we wait, we might not be able to get married. I feel really sad, though, that I didn't get to plan the kind of wedding I would have liked with a party and, you know, friends who were able to come from out of town. And that's what makes me angry, is just like, I had to, you know, kind of sort of compromise on not a very grandiose dream, but I had to compromise on my dream because I just didn't feel safe. It just felt like this man hates me. And Pence really hates me and has done his darndest to, you know, enforce laws against me. And I don't know what's going to happen.
Kate Jackman there. We'll be hearing from people who support the president soon. For Kate, politics became personal, and that's what happened for our next contributor. When Donald Trump got hired by the American people, Andrea Ignacio couldn't help but compare it to her own hunt for a job. She's originally from Colorado and works in Bahrain as a chiropractor. She's been trying to transition into a new career for 5 years now, and it's been a struggle.
When you read job ads, they say you must have 5 or 6 or 7 years of experience. Senior person, you must have a degree, you must have this ability, this ability, this ability. So I look at Donald Trump and I think my first thought after he was elected was, this is somebody that none of these CEOs would hire. None of these business people in any position, in any organization would interview this person, see these videos of him speaking, and want this person as an employee. He's clearly somebody who will cause problems in a job for which he is not qualified and does not have the demeanor. And so when he was elected, I just thought, the unfairness of it struck me that yet another person who has influence and money is able to transition into something far beyond anything that the rest of us are looking for in a job. And yet someone like me, I am qualified, I'm a good person, people do trust me once they've worked with me. I can't find even the simplest job transition to move into. And it just I didn't understand it. I don't understand it now. I don't understand how somebody that most of us would never hire for a secretarial position is now the president of the United States, based on the same negative personality traits that every HR office will tell you every psychologist will probably say, don't hire this person is toxic. And yet somehow it's acceptable now in a president. I don't understand it. And it's been very frustrating. And it's made me realize the even more unstable ground all of us are on in looking for jobs, especially if we're trying to to change careers. It's like nothing makes sense anymore.
That was Andrea Ignacio. You're listening to The Response, America's Story, smartphone recordings about your experiences in the first 100 days of Donald Trump's presidency. Like Andrea, lots of you wanted to talk to us about jobs and work. Larry Snell grew up near Detroit, and things are looking pretty good.
Since he took office, I was actually hired on permanent. I landed pretty comfortably, I guess. I am a follow-up coordinator, actually. I track the parts that builds the cages and robots for the auto industry. So Chrysler, Ford, U.S., Volvo, and some other outsources as well, Tesla. So we got a lot of customers.
For 10 years, Larry had been contracting through a temp agency. It's been hard, but he stuck with it in the hope of a permanent position. And in July, he got a phone call.
They were calling me back because they were considering hiring me on. So, you know, it's just coincidental that when Trump took office, I coincidentally land permanent. I'm happy about that. I can live comfortably. I can plan vacations with my wife. I have a lot of trees around my house I don't feel so bad about now because I can have them trimmed and I don't have to worry about my mortgage. I can talk to my wife about, you know, getting her a new car. And I was on her health insurance and I didn't want her to suffer any consequences for that. So now I have my own, and it's almost like, I know I'm married, but it's almost like I'm feeling a sense of independence again. It's great. I am African American, but you know, we've only had one African American president. I was hoping things would open up when he took office, but you know, it's no different than me hoping things would open up when Donald Trump took office. So I've never relied on big government. I've always had a sort of conservative views, but I'm optimistic about anyone who's elected to the highest office in this land. I'll give anybody the benefit of the doubt. The glass is always half full with me.
That was Larry Snell, who, like Donald Trump, recently got a new job. And we stay in the world of work in this story.
I work for an engineering and construction company in Houston. I would like to be known as the engineer for this recording because my identification may create unforeseen problems with my coworkers and maybe even my clients. One of my coworkers with whom I have an excellent professional relationship, we get along great. He said to me, "You might be locked up now that Trump is elected." So this remark was followed by a few chuckles around the conference table. It was a bit of a shock because it's been a long time since my ethnicity was the butt of a joke. Psychologically, it is sometimes a challenge to deal with the regular hate that seems to spew from his rallies and pronouncements. My wife, who is white, is now worried that Trump has made hate speech acceptable in the mainstream conversation. But I just put my blind faith in the strength of our country and the goodness of a large majority of our people.
That was the engineer talking about feeling like an outsider in the workplace, something he hadn't experienced in years. John Brooks is from Blue Hill, Maine. He's been a boat builder most of his life, making the kind of boats Donald Trump might buy.
We build custom boats that a very small segment of the population can afford. It started for me maybe a couple of months after the election, so, you know, January. What I get is the middle of the night, I'll wake up with my heart racing. and it's racing pretty fast. I went in for a physical, and I talked about it, and she said, well, we should get that checked out and see what's going on. I had thought about it some, and I said, you know, there is a lot of stress in our lives. You know, money is tight, and we've been very stressed over the election. I was talking to one of the nurses or something on the phone, and her point was that they are seeing a lot of people with stress-related illnesses and problems coming through the door these days. Since the election, and she said it's across the board, you know, conservatives, liberals, you know, just everybody, young, old, everybody are showing more and more signs of stress-related disorders.
It doesn't help John's health when he thinks about his finances. He works in a niche industry, but the fact that it's a luxury market doesn't mean he's financially safe. It takes longer to affect him, but swings in the wider economy have a big impact on him.
Since we're way up here in the corner, we're, you know, a small state, population-wise, we're a small state, and way up in the corner, we weren't affected by the recession in 2008, 2009 as quickly as a lot of other parts of the country. But then once it settled in, it has stayed for a long time. And so for us, having Trump become president, where we see his policies leading, we're just going to get knocked down again. Back in 2009, I was working for a boatyard, and we were working on a 90-footer. And when that project got done, the yard laid off about half its crew. But the wage that I was getting from that yard is the wage I'm getting now, almost 10 years later. I was getting benefits at the other yard and that kind of stuff. So in a lot of ways, my real wages have gone down a lot. So we are constantly looking to figure out how to dig ourselves out of a hole. Right now, I'm treading water with the job I've got. What we're stressed out about is what could happen.
That was John Brooks. Tanya Ellis describes herself as a writer with a day job, but her employment has got less steady, and it's made her think about politics and celebrity.
So far, the first 100 days of Trump look exactly like the 8 years of Barack. And I feel free to say that freely because I'm an African-American, and as far as it goes, I just got laid off again. And just like during the 8 years of Barack, it was a lot of up and down employment in reference to a very unstable economy. I actually lived in New York for many, many years in the zone of like 18 years as I'm in my 40s, and ended up moving back to the Houston, Texas area, which is where I'm from. So far, this looks about the same because Trump has not created any jobs. When I did live in New York, I used to live with my ex who we had a live-in situation. He was biracial, Irish and African-American, and we lived up in Harlem. And during that time period, this was probably the early 2000s, we actually had a group of migrant workers. And my ex at the time, or my boyfriend at the time, had asked me how I knew they were Mexicano. And I told him, I'm like, look, I'm from Texas. It's Cinco de Mayo.
The Mexicans were partying and they chatted to Tanya. She says they told her they were day laborers working construction on a Donald Trump property.
So even if you want to pull in the issue of Trump and his fancy wall, the problem with these very wealthy people who own the sun, the moon, and the stars is they run everything, and things that they claim that they're standing for politically don't hold up because they really have so much going on in terms of their empires. They don't know when they're contradicting themselves.
That was Tanya Ellis on politics and property. The next topic really came through in the stories you sent us. We heard it again and again. Arguments, strained friendships, and flaring tempers may be easily visible online. But as you're about to hear, they're spilling over into the real world.
Well, my name is Harrison Judd, and I live in Willimantic, Connecticut. Initially, as I spoke to friends, they were willing to let me be a Trump supporter because the feeling was, well, there's no way he can win. And when he won, things changed, and things changed very dramatically in many of the relationships. People were very upset, very angry. They challenged me on my support for Donald Trump. They said, he's a racist. How can you support a racist? How can you support a Nazi? And I would ask them, I would say, well, how is he a racist? How is he a Nazi? What has he said specifically? Generally, those conversations really never got a specific answer. People just got very angry. For example, my wife and I went to a dinner party about 6 weeks ago to see some old friends. And one of the friends played a few videos that was mocking of Trump. And that's fine. I mean, you know, political candidates should be mocked. But at the end of it, I began to talk about how I had noticed in some of the media outlets that I normally visit, there was a bias. I was noticing a bias that I did not feel it was being reported fully or accurately. And immediately, a man who I had only met at this party looked at me across the table and just said, "You're an And I couldn't believe it. You know, it sort of ended very quickly after that. But the point is, for me, is that I have not been able to have conversations. It is so loaded that if you say you support the president or any part of the president's agenda, or indicate that you might have supported him or didn't vote for Hillary even, you're immediately labeled and people are angry at you and people are upset. The issues really never get to a point of discussion. I have not been able to sit at the table or across a cup of coffee from any of my friends and have an actual calm conversation. And this has simply blown my mind because many of these people I've known for decades. We're able to have different belief systems on all kinds of levels. I'm an artist. My wife is an artist. Many of our friends are artists. And I mean, these are accusations that have never occurred in my life. I've never been called a racist before. Passion takes over all reason. I mean, it seems to me that in a democracy, there's two points of view at least. I mean, there should be as many as possible. Each individual should have a point of view, and they should be allowed that point of view.
You're listening to The Response, America's Story, smartphone recordings about your experiences in the first 100 days of Donald Trump's presidency. That was Harrison Judd. These fractured friendships and public tensions are easy to see on social media, but they're simmering away in the real world. That's a big part of this story sent in by Victoria Benalis. She lives right here in Boise. She's a Basque woman who came to America to study for a graduate degree. She became a U.S. citizen in 2005 and works as a translator.
I love Boise. I've met many wonderful people in this town. And even though my friends have different political viewpoints, I've loved and respected every single person for who they are. But unfortunately, you know, some of this changed last November when I found out that at least four of my female friends had voted for Donald Trump. I suddenly looked at these people that I had respected and called friends. I was shocked and disappointed that my so-called friends would help put someone like him in power. It really made me reconsider our friendship and made me wonder what they really thought about me, an immigrant, a foreigner. What did they think about me behind my back? These friends are educated white women. How could they vote for Trump? How could they support an unstable and hate-filled candidate who makes obscene comments about women, mocks the disabled, calls migrants rapists? I can no longer look at these friends the same way. Voting for Trump or not, in my view, has nothing to do with partisan political opinions. It's an entirely different thing that I just cannot understand. And I still love this country, but this new reality is really disheartening. I have a sense of doom and anguish and hopelessness about our future. And I'm sad to have to distance myself from these four friends. But choosing to support Trump's hate is something that I just can't forgive.
You heard there from Victoria, who's Basque. She's one of more than 15,000 Basque people who live here in Boise. And I'm here with KBSX reporter Frankie Barnhill, who can tell me more about the Basque-Boise connection.
Oh, absolutely. So this is downtown Boise, and we're on a street called the Basque Block. And
I can see why.
Right, you can see why. You know, Basque flags all around.
There is the Basque Museum and Cultural Center over here, and there is a gift shop with all those flags and beautiful artifacts, and of course the restaurants.
Yes, this is a cultural center in the downtown that is very special to Boiseans, for sure. Basque country is between Spain and France in the Pyrenees. They've never had their own country. Parts of their culture and language, though, have survived for like 20 centuries. Boise is one of the places in the West they've settled. The mayor of Boise is Basque. His name's Mayor Dave Beter, and he is a Democrat.
Tell me about the political engagement here. Are people generally, whether they're Republican or Democrat, are they politically engaged?
Yeah, 88% of eligible voters voted in this area, which says a lot. They voted in large part for Trump. Trump won by about 48% to 38% to Clinton. The legislature is, by a large majority, Republican. The state has been a Republican stronghold for many decades. The governor is Republican. The congressional delegation is all Republican. And that says a lot about how the split between Boise and the rest of the state kind of plays out.
It's interesting, though, because it means that generally in Idaho, the Donald Trump message has resonated.
Absolutely. Idaho is obviously more rural than a lot of states. People here aren't too interested in having the federal government involved in their day-to-day lives. There's a lot of attitude of self-determination, and Idaho also has a significant Mormon population that has conservative social values.
But, you know, walking around Boise, I've seen so many young people, and I don't know why, but I didn't expect to see that. I've spoken to some of them, university students, who, you know, one has moved from California to here. Others say that this is where they want to live.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of young energy here, and the art culture is really strong as well. There's a place I'd love to show you in downtown Boise if you want to go.
Is it near here?
It's near close, yeah. Okay. It's just a couple blocks away.
Let's go.
Yeah, so I wanted to take you to what's called Freak Alley.
Freak Alley. Should I be scared?
Maybe just be a little bit on the edge. I don't know.
here we go.
Don't be scared at all. Here
Freak
it is.
Alley,
yes,
Gallery.
Freak Alley. And so this is a public art display. It's graffiti that is sanctioned. So, you know, lots of different artists contribute here. What do you think?
Sweet. I love this skull thing over the door. Can we go there?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
I don't know how old you are, but obviously you're fairly young. So people your age actually see themselves living here, working here for the long haul?
Yes. Speaking as an actual millennial, I can say that there are more people who are trying to stick around and see Boise as a place that they want to stay, do their art here, you know, work here, and really put their roots down.
Well, thank you so much for bringing me here. I mean, I was going to tell you, do you have any recommendations for where to hang out? But actually, I'm just going to hang out here.
Yeah, I'll see you taking selfies all day.
Thanks, Frankie.
Thank you.
Social media played an unprecedented role in the November election. Get ready for some online activism and a relatively new political phenomenon, the Facebook fallout. Here's Dave from California.
I'm married to a Colombian Catholic who happens to be part black. My sister's a school teacher. My mom was a school teacher. So given that background, who would you guess that I voted for? The answer is Trump, and I would absolutely vote for him again. And it wasn't a vote for hate, as we're often characterized. It was rather a vote for what I believe is a view of smaller government.
Dave was on Facebook when he responded to a post by a friend's son about the laptop ban on some Middle Eastern flights. It got heated. There were accusations of racism, and eventually, one of Dave's comments from years ago was posted as evidence of homophobia. He resented it. He says he marched against a proposal to ban gay marriage in California. Pretty soon, a virtual argument had led to a big fallout in the real world. His former friends won't speak to him.
It continues to be remarkable to me that while the left speaks passionately against intolerance and labels, they are so quick to label and be intolerant of those that oppose their very narrow view of the world and the ideologies within it. My general view, and the reason I dive in these arguments, is that both sides come about their positions from views of love. Those that are for abortion aren't in favor of killing babies, they are in favor of women's rights and don't view it as a life. Those that are pro-life aren't anti-women's rights. They believe it is a life. Both are views stemmed in love, and that is lost as each side seeks to label the other. Back to my undoubtedly common Facebook tale, hopefully this family that I do continue to care about will one day let me back in, let us back in, but for now, they are choosing to vilify and close communication with anyone who doesn't share their narrowly defined views.
That was Dave. Rachel Gucci has had a better experience online. She's found herself with more friends than ever.
I'm a stay-at-home mom in Boise, Idaho, and right after the election, some of my stay-at-home mom friends decided to have a get-together to write letters about various issues to our local members of Congress. Everybody had a blast writing letters and going to the Women's March together, and we're feeling really fired up, but didn't want to spam our Facebook pages or have a forever group text going on to get together for all this. So somebody had the idea to start a Facebook group, and they decided to call it Boise Moms for a Brighter Future. So it started with about 8 people, and then everybody added a couple more people they knew that they thought would be interested, and a couple more, and a couple more. And then before we knew it, we had 700 members.
The mass group of Boise Moms has been busy. They coordinate meetings and letter-writing drives, they discuss how to visit members of Congress, and they bring their children. They even sent the representatives Valentine's cards, and they're not stopping there.
We figured out how to Facebook Live our huddles so people could watch that, so we've been feeling very millennial with these things. But it's been kind of funny, because since we are just a bunch of stay-at-home moms who previously felt pretty proud every 4 years when we got to wear our I voted sticker, we've been very bumbling with all of this and finding that we really need to decide, how do we be active and how do we be the most effective that we can be while still being dedicated to our families, still raising children with values, strong values that we hope will resonate with our own values, and how to just not burn out. So it's been an interesting journey for all of us these last 100 days.
Rachel Gucci there with some stay-at-home moms who plan to stay online. You're listening to The Response, America's Story, smartphone messages about your experiences in the first 100 days of Donald Trump's presidency. Before the Facebook Moms of Idaho, we heard Dave falling out with friends. Deborah lives in Oregon, and her fallout has been with family. She's always had political differences with her brother, but they kept in touch. Since the election, however, everything's changed.
We primarily communicate by email or text or telephone, and I don't do that much anymore because I had to cut him off. I really tried to listen to what he was saying about why he was in favor of Trump, and it basically boiled down to Fox News sound bites. There was nothing I could say, apparently, that was going to change his mind, or there were no facts, there was no data, there were no reliable sources, and it was a bit frustrating. And so before the election, I basically decided to agree to disagree and see how the election came out. At that point, I was reasonably confident that Ms. Clinton was going to win. Apparently, I was wrong.
Deborah didn't get the results she wanted, and political differences over the election will have consequences for her family. You can find out what happened after this. you're listening to The Response, America's Story. Before the break, you heard Deborah from Oregon, who had previously kept in contact with her brother online, despite their political differences. Deborah began to read about a rise in hate crimes after the election. Someone even shouted at her friend's son, who was adopted from Korea. They said, "Go home. It's Trump's America now." The story really upset Deborah, not least because she adopted a son who's Hispanic.
Needless to say, there was a lot of fear going on. So I asked my brother, "Dear brother, you voted for these people." I basically gave him everything he needed. I said, "Would you please let your president and your representatives and your senators know that you expect them to denounce these hate crimes and to tell people to stop it?" And he declined. He basically said, as long as my son or anybody else had their papers in order and followed the law, they would not have a problem. And at that point, I realized that there really is nothing to say, nor am I willing to associate with someone who basically isn't willing to even consider that there might be systemic problems or isn't willing to consider the impact on people in his own family. This is his nephew we're talking about. My own brother isn't willing to do anything as simple as asking his elected representatives to denounce reprehensible hate crimes. Well, I don't need that person in my life. If he calls me, I may or may not pick up the phone. I won't call him. I don't email him. I don't text him. I'm sorry that he feels that way, but it doesn't belong in my life. I have enough to deal with as it is.
That was Deborah, one of several people who sent us stories about the strains that politically polarized arguments have placed on relationships. One of the biggest stories of Donald Trump's first 100 days in office has been his administration's attempt to replace the Affordable Care Act. Republicans tried to rally the numbers needed to pass a new bill, but failed, and the president decided to put the policy aside. April from Boise has a pre-existing condition.
I have an autoimmune genetic disorder. Crohn's disease has rendered me close to death 3 times now. For the majority of the time that I have had this disease, I've not been able to access or afford the medicine that I need because I had a pre-existing condition. With the Affordable Care Act, I can now access that care, and incidents that would in the past lead to hospitalizations and missed work and pain and suffering have been reduced. I think that people have a misunderstanding about who benefits from the Affordable Care Act. I am an educated person. Most recently, last year, I graduated with a master's degree. I've put myself through school, and I've supported myself and lived independently. I have 2 jobs. One is full-time, where I help children who have been abused and to help provide safety nets and prevent that child abuse from happening again. I also have a part-time job doing disaster preparedness work for the state. Neither of these jobs offer health care benefits. My medications are over $7,000 a month. Without the health care exchange, I can't get the care that I need. Currently, I have missed 2 weeks of work. Fortunately, I have understanding employers. But what happens when I can no longer afford my insurance premiums due to not being able to work? I will then have no health care because Idaho refuses to expand Medicaid to those of us who are single and who are unable to afford our insurance. I live in fear. My future is under attack. My safety and well-being is under attack. Without access to health care, it is literally a death sentence for me.
That was April. Erin Murray is from Boise, too. She's been trying to get more involved in democracy, but it hasn't been easy.
As a fairly liberal person living in a really conservative state, it's been incredibly frustrating trying to engage with my representatives. I've called, I've written, and, you know, left messages and emailed the offices of my representatives to try and express my opinions about some of the policies and some of the nominees who are being put in place by Donald Trump. And all I kind of get is a form letter back, and it really just feels like a pat on the head and saying, you know, thank you for reaching out. It's important that we hear from you, but we're just going to go ahead and do whatever we want or what we think most of the constituents in Idaho want, which is, it's incredibly frustrating. I mean, I understand that, you know, I have a choice of living in this state, and I know that it's very conservative and my political opinions differ from most of the people in the state. But I still feel unrepresented in Congress and in the nation's capital. And it's just incredibly frustrating. So I don't look forward to much more of that happening. I do have some hope for the midterm elections in 2018, but it's still, with how conservative Idaho is, I'm not sure that really that much is going to change. So it's been a discouraging time.
Erin Murray referred to politics in Boise there, but the state has some challenges which are forcing different groups to work together.
I'm looking at two huge water pipes. And when I say huge, you can actually drive a big truck through each one of them. And they're blasting water, which is spraying all across the bit of the river that I'm looking at. I am at the Lucky Peak Dam on the Boise River, and I'm here with Samantha Wright, a Boise native and longtime reporter for KBSX. Samantha, tell me why you brought me here.
The Boise River is flooding. There's a whole lot of water and a whole lot of snow above this dam and the two other dams behind it. So they're letting as much out as they can because the snow is starting to melt. And as the snow melts, it's causing flooding downstream in Boise and the places behind it. And so the more water they let out, the more flooding there is, and the businesses and the homes are in a lot of trouble.
Does it always jet as much water as we're looking at right now?
No, it doesn't. We got 39 inches of snow this year in Boise alone, and even more further up in the mountains. And that's more than we've had since 1986. And now everybody's, oh no, what are we going to do? If they can't get enough water out of the dams, it'll overflow the dams and we'll have real flooding in the Boise River. So they're flooding it a little bit right now.
Controlled flooding.
Correct. Controlled flooding.
Tell me about the economy side of it, because surely many, many businesses depend on the land here.
They do. And it's a weird mix in Idaho. We've got ranchers and miners and loggers, and they all want to use public land. We've got environmentalists. They want to keep the land pristine. We even have lawmakers who say there's no such thing as climate change. Folks love the land. They just can't always agree on how to take care of it.
How easy is it to get people from different interest groups to sit together and talk about land management?
It's not that easy in Idaho, but one example would be one of our congressmen. He's a Republican, Mike Simpson, and he worked for more than a decade to try and get a wilderness area in Idaho. So what Mike Simpson was able to do was bring all these sides together, and it shows you can do it. It's not always easy. It can take a lot of time and a lot of effort, but if you keep trying, as he did, you can get everyone to agree on something.
We're at a fantastic spot, albeit a bit, I don't know, sprayy and wet, but amazing. If I have a couple of more days here in Idaho, in Boise, where should I go? What should I do?
Normally, I would say to go to the Boise Greenbelt. 26 miles of pathway. It's right along the river.
Greener than this?
Much greener than this, yes. People bike on it, and they walk on it. They walk their dogs on it. They love it. But it's mostly underwater right now because the river's flooding, and the Greenbelt is the first thing to go. So go to the Boise Foothills. 190 miles of trails and pathways that are above the city. There are eagles and foxes and deer and mountain lions and beautiful landscape.
Sounds wonderful. Thanks, Samantha.
You're welcome.
Our next contributor, Cheryl Dieter, had an experience which stuck with her, and it made her think about poverty, America, and its relationship with food.
My name is Cheryl Dieter. I'm from Visalia, California. After church, I visited a woman who was pregnant, and she was due next week. Her house is in a pretty blighted neighborhood around my church, and it's very small, about the size of someone's living room, and there's really no furniture except a bed in there. She didn't have a stove. She only had a microwave. She had people living out in a car in the front of her house because they had no place to live. When I saw this woman's house, I'm a person who is fortunate to have, and she's a person who has not. She basically has nothing. It tore at my heart. It made me look around even more to see the rampant poverty. It's easy for me not to see it because I don't live it. She had no food in her house, and she was living in a place that really should be condemned. And I started thinking about, what is the future for this child? How is this child going to survive? It got me thinking because I had talked to teachers who discussed about the fact that they'd have kids coming in to school on Monday that were kind of hazy and dazy because they just didn't have food during the weekend. And, you know, we know that children who are in poverty and are not getting food will have developmental delays and they will struggle in school. Their brains don't develop normally. And when I saw that President Trump was wanting to cut the school lunch programs, it horrified me. So we have a big problem with people not having money to buy food. And yet what's ironic is I live in an area that grows some of the most food in the whole world, in the Central Valley. We have fruits and vegetables galore, and we have people who are picking them who can't afford to eat. And it makes you wonder, how will they grow up to be adults that are functioning when their brains are being challenged from lack of food?
That was Cheryl Dieter. Anastasia wanted to talk to us about religion. She didn't want to use her full name. We'll let her explain why.
I live in a very small farming community in Illinois. The majority of my neighbors, my coworkers, people in this community were avid Trump supporters. And they show kind of an overt sense of pride about that. And you know, that's great that their candidate won and they're happy about that. But I think now they feel that conservative Christianity has been vindicated by the election of Trump. And I should preface that I have a minority religion. I am a Hellenic polytheist. We're a small branch of the larger pagan community. And so it's become kind of scary for me to even, you know, self-identify in any way with my religion.
Previously, Anastasia might have worn a pagan symbol, and she has a tattoo that she's now careful to cover up.
You don't talk about the big three at work. You don't talk about sex, politics, or religion. But there have been several attempts since the Trump administration has come in for people to kind of find out who at work is Christian and who isn't, or who in the community is Christian and who isn't. Asking little questions, oh, where do you go to church? Oh, do you believe in this or do you believe in that? And I try to ignore most of it or just smile and nod, but it's become uncomfortable. Before, I may have, for example, had bumper stickers on the back of my car that I self-identified with me and my faith. I ripped all those off. And so it's become kind of scary for me that if I were to self-identify or self-identify my family as being part of the pagan community, that we would suffer for it.
That was Anastasia. Joe Medrano has also been fielding questions at work. He's from Jackson, Michigan, and these days, he doesn't know which side of the political fence he's on. But he does know one thing. There's a lot of anger out there.
Within the first 7 days after Trump was elected, I was called out many times for my support for Obama and the ACA, or Obamacare, whatever you want to call it. And it seemed emboldened to start picking on me because I thought it was a good idea. And the people who who wouldn't take you outside, who were rare to call somebody out. Even it just surprised me that even those people who weren't vocal most of the time, kept their opinions to themselves, felt emboldened when Trump got elected that they could pick on somebody who voted for the ACA or Obama.
Leaving aside the arguments he's had since the election, Joe believes the way we characterize the two main parties and their supporters is getting worse.
It seems nowadays that if you're Republican, your idea is you don't like the poor and you want them to die or just go away. As a liberal Democrat, you want to give away everything, but it's not that simple, and I don't find myself in either camp now. I have to admit, and I hate to admit it, I think Trump did one thing right so far. The Republicans didn't have a plan after they threw out Obamacare. So he says, hey, you can't get it together. We're moving on. That's the smartest thing I've seen any president do at this point. They didn't have a plan. I've seen him on television. I didn't like his program much. I think he's the biggest buffoon ever was. And I wanted to vote for him because I was angry with the government just as well. But I couldn't do that to it. I mean, that was like the nuclear option. And it's like, well, they've already made inroads to disband, defund, or get rid of EPA, which that's going to be such a mistake. Oh, my. You know, the first thing they really should have done was take away his Twitter account, but smarter heads are not prevailing. The only way you're going to survive this presidency is to have a few dollars. Oh, I'm working my ass off. I'm working for every dime I can get. So I'm paying down debt. I won't buy a damn thing, and I'm working myself into the ground. You've sparked so much in this. I'm not sure exactly where to go with it.
That was Joe Medrano, with a lot to say on the subject of feeling politically homeless. Yvette Ward is 70. She lives right here in Boise, and she never really thought of herself as political. Sure, she's always voted, but her attitude has changed since the last election.
I apparently mistakenly believed that I could trust those elected to act in the best interest of the people who had elected them. But maybe it was true when I was growing up, but I got woke by the last election and find that no, that is no longer true. So for the first time in my life, I am active politically. I am a moderator of two Facebook groups as well and responsible for promoting weekly action steps on state and national issues in one of those, attend meetings and that sort of thing. My dad was a high school dropout who later became an Air Force officer and was in the Burma Bridgebuster Squadron in World War II. I remember throughout my first 50 years having a sense that anything I decided to do was possible, so much so that in my mid-40s, I decided to change careers. I completed then my bachelor's degree and got a master's and a doctorate by the time I was 53 years old. Unfortunately, now I see little in the way of possibility for anyone who isn't in the top 1% economically. And that leaves me with a sense of despair for my kids and grandkids.
That was Yvette Ward. Vicki Gale is from Payette in Idaho. Her response to the election was very specific. She switched off the news and decided to read fiction.
I have finished all of the Harry Potter series, and I'm going to quickly move into some more fiction and continue to do that because it is a great stress relief. Facebook was lots of responses with people who were happy to have him, which was fine. But I did end up unfollowing a lot of my friends and family because of the just anger and open hatred toward anyone who wasn't a Republican. And that seemed to me to be unleashed and welcomed by a president who emulated it, which was very disappointing.
Vicki decided that she couldn't survive on fiction and Facebook. She set to work rebooting her attitude to the media, exposing herself to new things, and at least trying to find common ground.
I have learned to lean to the right by listening I do listen to Fox and try to at least understand and hear a more conservative side. And then I look for points to agree on, because after all, these people, there are a lot of people that I love, and they are my family, and I want to be able to talk to them and not have to tiptoe, but rather do have conversations that aren't about me and what I want, but are more inclusive, and ask them what it is that they're looking for. And since then, I've found some interesting things. For instance, my sister and I were talking the other day, and she did want Trump as president. And we agreed on the most important issue for both of us was the need for universal health care. I was pleased to get there and to see that we might have different ways of wanting to go about that, but we do both want same things, and we do both are concerned about the same things. In the end, I try to look at things that I'm thankful for, so that when people ask me, what do you think, I can say, well, today I'm happy to read in the paper that the president removed Bannon from the Security Council, and that's the thing that I see moving in the right direction today. Otherwise, I'll tell you, I spend more time writing to my congressman than I ever have before, and that will probably continue. Thank you.
That was Vicki Gill in a media landscape that's never been louder, trying to listen. And we've enjoyed listening to you. That was The Response, America's Story. Thanks so much to everyone who sent us a smartphone story. As you can hear, over those 100 days, we've covered some ground.
Hi, this is Joyce, testing out my voice memo thing.
My name is Sarah. I live in Oklahoma City, and I am a millennial.
All right, my name is Dave Mertz, and I'm 35 years old from Fargo, North Dakota.
New Roads, Louisiana.
From Logan County, West Virginia.
From Louisiana.
And I live in Beaver, Pennsylvania.
I live in Oregon.
Stone Mountain. In Georgia.
Hialeah, Florida.
In Detroit.
I'm from Cincinnati, Ohio.
In San Antonio.
Just south of Seattle with my husband, James.
I consider myself an average Joe.
I was working, shoveling coal.
That was the first time in my life that I actually heard the word immigrant.
They were remarkable. They were survivors.
My dad looked at my mom and said, let's go.
I looked at myself in the mirror and I got angry.
This is my baby that cost me nothing, and then this is my $10,000 baby.
I don't know how I'm going to formally do it yet, but yeah, I can do it.
And that was The Response, America's Story. It was a BBC World Service production with American Public Media. The series was produced by Kevin Corr of the BBC with APM's Laurie Stern. And this episode was recorded at WBSX in Boise, Idaho. The editor was Nicola Swords. And I'm Shaima Khalil. Thanks for listening.